Welcome to another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein. Victoria Herman is a woman on a mission. The 25-year-old is the managing director, U.S., of the Arctic Institute, Center for Circumpolar Security Studies. The Arctic Institute is an interdisciplinary, independent think tank comprised of young professionals who work from locations around the world and who represent expertise in many different disciplines. Their main focus? Climate change. Victoria is a climate change specialist working on her PhD at Cambridge University's Scott Polar Research Institute. She is currently studying how images and aesthetic codes construct values, identities, and ideas of power in the Arctic. Yeah, easy for me to say. Victoria recently completed a Fulbright in Canada, while at the same time getting her master's in international affairs at Carleton University, where she researched Arctic Indigenous participation. She has presented her research across North America and Europe, including participating in President Obama's North Arctic meeting in Alaska in 2015. Alaska is where Victoria is headed and where she will spend the next several months. She is also a 2016 National Geographic Explorer who has received funds to write a book about climate change in America. So, Victoria, welcome and thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
I certainly hope I can hold up my end of the conversation and that you're going to speak English in this
I'll try
hour.
My best.
So have you always been science-oriented?
I've always had a science edge to me. I think from a young age, I realized that climate change and environmental issues were really the biggest problem facing my generation. And in order to tackle those, I realized that I needed both a grasp of science and policy. So since undergrad, I've been doing a bit of both.
How did you know as a teenager that climate change was such a huge problem?
I guess I'd have to attribute it to my environmental science teacher in high school. She really brought it to the forefront of every class that she taught, and I took those lessons with me. I researched outside of class. I got involved in other environmental clubs.
Spoke to you, huh?
Yeah, yeah. I got involved around northern New Jersey, which is where I grew up, in other environmental initiatives, and that kind of kickstarted me getting involved in a much wider climate conversation.
So when you went to college, you had a focus then, didn't you?
Yeah. No, I definitely went in freshman year to college knowing that I wanted to do something in international relations related to climate change. I think undergraduate, especially at a liberal arts school, provides a really wonderful foundation for doing a lot of things, but it doesn't give you the expertise that you need to be good at a particular thing.
Sure.
So I realized that I had to really hone in on some expertise, and that was climate change policy.
So you went on to graduate school, but in Canada, right? Why there?
For a few reasons. I think I've done all of my degrees in different countries, and I think there's real value in getting an education in different types of education systems.
Oh, interesting. Uh-huh.
Yeah, so knowing that I have my undergraduate in the United States system and then going to Canada and finally the UK for my PhD, it gives you different ways of knowing the world and knowing how to study these same subjects from different viewpoints. So
yeah.
I thought that was really important when I decided to go to Canada. Doesn't help that Canada has a lot of Arctic space, and that's what I was doing.
So that it was a perfect match.
Exactly.
And then how did you wind up at Cambridge? Well, you were obviously very smart enough to wind up at Cambridge, that's for sure.
Two things sent me over to Cambridge. The first is the Scott Polar Research Institute itself. It's really unique in the world in bringing lots of different disciplines together to study Arctic issues. So within the institute, we have natural scientists, we have social scientists, we have policy professionals, we have humanitarian professionals too.
Mm-hmm.
And all of those people come together to research the Arctic and work towards solutions. And I think that multidisciplinary team building is really important when you're working on things like climate change. But also, I was really interested in the Gates Cambridge Scholarship, which is what I'm on, what funds me at Cambridge.
So explain that.
Yeah, so the Gates Cambridge Scholarship is from the Gates Foundation.
As in Bill Gates.
Yes, yeah. So Bill
Gates. So it's relatively new?
It is relatively new, yeah. It's about 15 years old.
Okay.
And the mission of the Gates Cambridge Scholarship is to improve the lives of others. So each year they pick around 90 scholars from around the world. And the criteria for picking those PhD and master students is their ambitions to improve the lives of others in some way. And that really spoke to me because that's what drives me. And again, that multidisciplinary aspect comes in because it's not confined to one subject. Gates scholars are plant scientists, they're climate scientists, but they're also art historians. So it's a really cool community to see how people are affecting others' lives in really creative ways, and we bounce off of each other.
So as a Gates Scholar, your PhD is funded by this foundation.
Yeah, it's funded by a trust that got its money from Bill Gates.
But let's also embarrass you a little bit. I mean, this is a huge deal. To be a Gates Scholar, this is no small potato stuff.
It is quite selective. So there are 90 of us each year. And again, it's international, so it's not just American scholars.
No, I get it.
Everyone's. Mm-hmm. So it's
did you feel like you died and went to heaven when you were selected?
Oh yeah, it was a complete shock. The fact that I got an interview, and the interviews are at the Gates Foundation in Seattle. So mm-hmm. when I got that email, I was living in Canada at the time. I had a little bit of a panic attack.
Talk to us about what that process was like. Did you meet him? Did he interview you, or is it a panel of other people?
Yeah, so it was about a panel of 7 people, mm-hmm. and it's comprised of past scholars, from trustees, and from people who are viewed as experts in the area that you're applying for. So mine was mm-hmm. social science and policy.
Why was your social science?
Because I was applying with a PhD proposal to look at art in the Arctic and aesthetic codes. So
I know we're jumping all over the place. I'm reading this and I'm thinking, what the hell does this mean? What's an aesthetic code in the Arctic?
So my PhD is understanding why people think about the Arctic the way we do. So often the Arctic is pictured as just polar bears and icebergs, but actually
the Arctic is
more than that. Yeah, it's a homeland to 4 million people. So as I'm looking to create climate policies for the Arctic, you need to understand how people who have never visited the Arctic view it and then make decisions for it, which is so often policymakers in Washington, D.C.
Uh-huh.
And a big part of that is the visuals that they see in newspapers, that they see in documentaries, because that's what creates the Arctic for them. It's not going there and visiting, because so often they don't have the opportunity to do so.
Or the inclination either.
Yes.
You know?
Uh-huh. Oh, yes. So my PhD looks at how those visuals are affecting their policymaking. So I kind of understand who's making those decisions now and why. So I have a better grasp when I'm at that position.
Of making decisions.
Yep.
So the hope is that you kind of push some of these decision makers off to the side, for a lack of another way of describing it. I mean, getting rid of them, right?
Yeah. Kind of the next generation of thinkers in mm-hmm. climate change. And I don't think I'm alone in this. I think there'll be a general turnover of people who are working on climate policy now as we move it to becoming really the issue of the next century.
So it's reconfiguring how even an average Joe like me views the Arctic.
Exactly. Yeah.
And that it can really be user-friendly.
The Arctic is really accessible. And I think that's the take-home message of my PhD, is that the Arctic is not some last frontier. It's not some badlands where there's no law, there's no people, there's just ice and animals. Mm-hmm. But it really is connected to the rest of the world. It's connected to what we do. There are people living there that call it a homeland, just like you and I call New York and New Jersey a homeland.
Who calls it a homeland?
4 million people spread out across all 8 Arctic countries, and those vary tremendously. So you have Inuit and other indigenous peoples that call the Arctic home. Mm-hmm. You also have people in Alaska who may have migrated there over the past 2 centuries. Mm-hmm. The same with Canada and the Norwegian.
I was just going to say Norway and Finland and Iceland
and
we didn't get
Sweden.
Yeah.
Russia.
And are they just kind of like these lone souls out there? Is this an uphill battle?
It's definitely an uphill battle, but I think what's important when you're talking about the Arctic is to remember there are many different types of Arctics. So in Norway, for example, there is really an intimate connection between the southern part of Norway and the northern part of Norway, the Arctic Norway, because there is no barrier like you have with Alaska and the United States, where you have some 500 miles between the two.
Gotcha.
They do see it as this kind of consistent homeland, and the policies that are created in Oslo have an immediate effect on Tromsø, which is up in the Arctic. So mm-hmm. that's very, very different from kind of the Alaskan Arctic, for example, where it is quite small settlements that are very far removed from policymakers in D.C. and don't have that immediate connection with what many people would identify as the American homeland.
How long did that take before you found out that you became a Gates Scholar?
The applications are due at the beginning of fall, and then around November, December, you find out that you have an interview. And then in January, you head over to Seattle for the interview. And then the turnover is immediate. They make the decision if you are or not a Gates Scholar the day of your interview. And then they'll tell you a few days later whether you've gotten it.
So I said you were 25. How old were you when you were named a Gates Scholar?
I was 23.
23. And so you got into Cambridge University first.
Yes.
And then Gates is footing your bill and your research.
Exactly.
Pretty damn nice. If you're just joining us, my guest today is Victoria Herman. She is 25 years old, and I'm going to keep harping on that because that's really young. And she's a managing director, U.S., of the Arctic Institute, the Center for Circumpolar Security Studies. So you go to England and you start working on your PhD, knowing that you're going to be commuting to the Arctic?
Yes. Yeah. So there is a really big push of doing your field work in wherever you're studying. Mm-hmm. And for me, that includes not just doing my field work for my PhD, but also going to the Arctic to run events and to do research projects for the Arctic Institute. So,
which is how old?
The Arctic Institute was founded in 2011.
Oh, like you, young.
It is very young.
Uh-huh.
So there is a lot of commuting, but I think that, again, speaks to this idea that the Arctic is not so far removed, that you can go back and forth between the Arctic on a so-called commute. Mm-hmm. But many people do that. I'm not alone in that. And I mean, as an example, in the next few months, I'll be going to Alaska, back to Cambridge, but also to the Finnish Arctic, to the Russian Arctic, to the Norwegian Arctic, to Copenhagen, all on different kind of research projects or to run events. So there's a lot of commuting, but I'm not alone in doing all those commutes.
Speaking of alone, are you a lone female in this endeavor? Or am I being a little naive?
A lot of trips I am alone, yeah.
I don't mean A-L-O-N-E. I mean like the only woman.
I am not always the only woman. There is definitely a lot more men in the field of polar studies than there are women. And that stretches back where there's all this kind of masculinity wrapped up in polar exploration. Mm-hmm. And those are the people who really started the field. And that certainly extends, especially in Cambridge, which is a centuries-old institution that still has a little bit of sexism in it.
So you're an anomaly.
Yes, yeah.
And how does that work for you?
It usually isn't a problem. There are points where I am marginalized because of my gender.
And dismissed?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I think I see it a lot when I'm invited somewhere. And this could also be a bit of ageism, too, that I am younger than most of my colleagues. Where I'm invited somewhere, and then once I show up and they realize that I am a young female, mm-hmm. that I am almost immediately dismissed, or I'm not taken as seriously as the correspondence would have led me to believe before they saw who I was.
So what do you do about that?
I think you just have to be strong when that happens and show them why you're there, that, yes, I may be a young female, but that has no bearing on my research or mm-hmm. my endeavors, that I am quite good at what I do, and as long as you're confident in that, and not to say a cocky confidence, there's obviously always room to learn, but I think being a young woman in the field comes with extra baggage of having to stand up tall when you get to an event.
And almost always having to prove yourself?
Yes.
Yeah, it's really a shame. And I've seen this a lot in terms of the women I've had conversations with, photojournalists, whatever, you know, these anomalous kinds of situations. After a while, it just gets so tiresome to talk about, especially in 2016. You know, and science doesn't draw a lot of females.
Yeah. I'm used to all of this. And even before I moved into the Arctic sphere, I was working on transportation policy, which is also very heavily a men's field. So often I would go into a meeting where everyone would be a 50 and above white male, and everyone would just stop the meeting and look at me and ask if I was there to get coffee.
Oh, my God.
That happened twice in D.C. when I walked into a meeting.
Here, it happened here.
Yeah.
Does it happen abroad?
Absolutely.
Well, oh, phew. Yeah. You know, I would hate to think that we have the market on that,
yeah.
You know. Before you talk to me about the Arctic Institute, as I mentioned that you have presented your research across North America, including that you participated in the President's Arctic meeting in Alaska in 2015, what was that like?
It was really incredible. So President Obama had a large large-ish conference called the Glacier Conference, and it brought dignitaries from all 8 Arctic countries and the Arctic Observer states, so places like China, Singapore, Japan, but also organizations that are active around Arctic climate change issues in the United States. And most of those were in Alaska, and the Arctic Institute was one of the few that was not in Alaska. So I was there representing the Arctic Institute as an engaged organization in the issues he was working towards.
And a new organization.
Yes, a new organization, absolutely.
Right.
I think we were definitely one of the youngest there. I was definitely one of the youngest people there, other than the Arctic Youth Ambassadors, which are a group of high schoolers from Alaska that the State Department is working with. I was definitely one of the youngest people at Glacier.
Wow.
And our organization was certainly one of the youngest invited.
So what's this like for you when people insist that there is no issue with climate change?
I try to make it personal to whoever I'm talking to.
So make it personal to me.
I ask them why they don't think it's happening. And a lot of times it's because they don't see any tangible evidence from it. And so then I talk about my experiences and where I've been. So throughout 2016 and 2017, I'm traveling across the U.S. and the U.S. territories to talk to 500 plus Americans about what climate change means for them today. And so I just got back from about a month in American Samoa. And what I saw there was the shoreline eroding 5 feet a year, and people bringing me around and showing me that palm tree that you see 10 feet out, I used to hang on that as a child, and now it's 5 feet deep in water, and you're going to tell me climate change doesn't exist. So then I try to draw that back to something that person has experienced, whether that was Hurricane Sandy, whether that was Hurricane Katrina, whether they're in the Chesapeake Bay and they see subsidence.
But these are natural disasters. They happened all the time.
They do happen all the time, but climate change is making them happen more and more often. So then we get into a conversation of, do you experience different weather patterns? And we try to talk about how you might say that natural disasters happen all the time, but they're happening a lot more frequently now. And so then I talk to people about how many natural disasters have you seen in your lifetime?
Mm-hmm.
And go back and talk to your father, your grandfather, your mother, your grandmother, and ask them how many they've seen in their lifetime. And have a conversation not with me, who's a climate expert, but with somebody in your family about the differences in generations. And I think that's a lot more meaningful than me coming with statistics and saying, you know, this is happening in somewhere that they might not be familiar with, but for them to have a conversation with their family members and say, you know, this is something that I have never seen in my lifetime, and I'm 80, but you're seeing it 3 times in your lifetime, and you're 40. What does that mean?
Once again, if you're just joining us, my guest today is a climate change specialist, Victoria Herman, who is working on her PhD at Cambridge University Scott Polar Research Institute. I know that you're trying to personalize this, and that's really an important thing to do. I just wonder if this is like the myth of Sisyphus, as you're pushing this rock up a mountain that may be, you know, eroding. That part of it is so hard. Forget the research part. It's connecting with people and saying, this is really serious stuff.
Oh, absolutely. And I think it is an uphill battle, but when we're talking about changing perceptions, eventually, yes, everyone's perception should change about climate change, but ultimately, right now, the most important people's perceptions to change is the people who hold power to make decisions about climate change. And that's who you have to target in these. That it's important to talk to your neighbor who might deny climate change, but it's even more important to kickstart that conversation in the federal government, in the state government, and move those decision makers forward. And even though that's an uphill battle, that's a little bit less of an uphill battle because you're not looking at changing millions of minds. You're looking at changing 4 minds, and you concentrate all of your efforts and all of your research to changing those 4 minds, because that could really make a difference.
But have you found that there are more governments that are responsive than ours?
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
I mean, are we, you know, kind of the end of the line here?
I wouldn't say we're the end of the line. And the Obama administration has certainly been a strong advocate for climate change. I think that especially over the past 2 years, he has done an incredible amount for climate change, both action and rhetoric. Mm-hmm. So I really applaud what he's done. And I think that has, maybe when he started in 2008, we were towards the back of the line. But in these past 2 years, he has brought us to the forefront.
And who is at the forefront?
in the Arctic, I would definitely say it's the Scandinavian countries. They take it a lot more seriously, and they don't have this issue of climate deniers. I mean, no one else in the world has this issue of climate deniers
except us, other than
the U.S.
Oh, yeah. How nice to have a... Oh, for heaven's sake.
Yeah. So, although I will say in the Arctic, up until Prime Minister Trudeau was elected in Canada last fall, Canada was definitely behind everyone else in the Arctic in climate change research and acceptance. Yeah, because before Prime Minister Trudeau came into office, Prime Minister Harper was a hesitant climate change, I wouldn't even say believer, because he didn't really talk about it much. He really was centered on fostering Canada as a petrostate, and you could see that in his really robust support for things like the tar sands and the Keystone Pipeline. And during his 10 years in office, Canada didn't really do anything for climate change in the Arctic. So that really brought them to the back of the line, and it hurt people in the north who are seeing the effects of climate change today.
So tell me about the Arctic Institute. Who formed it? And again, I don't need to keep harping on this, but you know, you're young, you're 25, and you became the managing director, U.S., of this organization. Come on, Victoria, that's impressive. I mean, even you have to acknowledge that, right?
Yeah.
She says grudgingly, yeah.
Yeah, it's, I mean, I am incredibly thankful for the opportunity to get to run an organization at such a young age, and it's both personally and professionally, it has helped me incredibly to develop not just who I am, but how I see my career panning out, particularly after I defend my dissertation and my doctorate and what I want to do after that next year. So I'm really thankful for that. And I do have to thank the founder who was running the organization prior to me taking it over, Malte Humpert. And he created it in 2011, really as this idea that no one was giving a nuanced analysis of the Arctic and providing policymakers with what's really going on. There was a lot of this kind of big rhetoric around
like hysterical
Cold War
kind of stuff.
And front lines of climate change and all of these creations of the Arctic that weren't really giving you what the issues were. And so he created a web platform where young scholars that didn't have a place to put their research and analysis out to a public and policymaking audience on the web. And from there, he built it over the past 3 years into a really great organization of a network of young professionals in North America and in Europe who are writing and researching about the Arctic and now running events to better engage people who might not, again, have the opportunity to head up north, but really need to understand what's going on up there.
So what do you do?
What do I not do?
Oh, aha. Do you get paid for this?
No.
Okay.
No. Yeah. I do not get paid for this, although we're hoping to get paid. So the Arctic Institute was created as a web platform, and I took over more leadership at the beginning of last year and have kind of taken on more and more leadership until I became the managing director. And I had a vision for the organization to make it more than a publishing platform online. So I legally incorporated it in the United States as a nonprofit. So we're able to apply for grants, which is what we're doing. And I've done a few other things to make it into a real organization. So I created a board of directors, which are all really great, but they span from California to Korea. So it's a bit hard to get them all on one conference call. And I've made kind of strategies, so strategic visions for the organization, communication strategies, really the foundation of a startup. And that has taken up a lot of the past year in creating editorial guidelines, creating a peer review process, making sure that all of the staff seems supported and that they're getting everything they need to do the research that they're doing, to ensure that we're publishing 1 to 3 pieces a week, that we're holding an event each week, that we do get calls from the media quite often and keeping that up, making sure that we are informing policymakers so we get calls from senators, not just in the U.S., but in Norway and other countries, too, to give them nuanced information
but
about the
no
Arctic.
But there's no other organization like yours that came before you, before the Arctic Institute?
No, not really. Yeah.
Because the focus is solely on the Arctic.
The focus is solely on the Arctic. And I think that's really what sets us apart, that there are a lot of other think tanks that have one person who works on the Arctic that isn't an Arctic expert. So they see that the Arctic is kind of a hot topic now. So they'll have their European expert or their energy and climate expert do Arctic work, but they don't have a background in Arctic science or Arctic policy, which all of our researchers do. They do have degrees, either PhDs or masters, focused on the Arctic. And that's really what sets us apart, is that we've dedicated ourselves to research on the region to give a lot better, I think, information to people than someone who is doing this in addition to what they actually specialize in.
And you were saying that you're a nonprofit. So where does a good chunk of your funds come from?
Mostly foundations.
Okay.
Yeah. So although we are applying to things like the National Science Foundation, which is in part funded by the U.S. government, but a lot of our funds or in-kind donations are from other nonprofits or universities in the United States and in Norway, from foundations, and also from private donors like the Norwegian Ship Owners Association, who believe in making a more secure and sustainable Arctic and want to see us ensure that that vision is achieved.
So what do you see in the future?
I am optimistic about the future for the Arctic. And I think most of that stems from what the Obama administration has done over the past year. I think there is a tremendous amount of work that still needs to be done. I also think that the Arctic really is a peaceful region, that despite all of this rhetoric from the media of the next Cold War in the Arctic, and that there are overlapping claims to the Arctic seabed, and that crises like Ukraine are going to spill over into the Arctic, despite all of this, there really has been cooperation between all actors in the Arctic over the past year. And that gives me a lot of hope that that will continue, that despite everything else that's going on, we are able to come together in places like the Arctic Council, where Russia and the United States and Finland and Norway can come together and work towards a more sustainable
you
Arctic.
You have a common goal.
Exactly.
You share a common goal. And so how many people are involved in this organization?
There are 13 of us on the team, and that's mostly who do the research, the outreach, the planning of events.
The policy.
And then we obviously have our board of directors, and we have a board of advisors as well. And we try to engage as many people as possible. So we have lots of local partners, like the Arctic Youth Ambassadors, which I mentioned a bit earlier. We're working with them throughout this year to get more youth perspectives onto our site, because we see them as the leaders of the future.
No kidding.
Much like us, young professionals, they don't really have a good platform to talk about the issues that matter to them most and that they want to try to tackle in the future. So we're working with them and Students on Ice and a few other youth organizations in the Arctic to give them a way to talk about those issues. So they're publishing on our website. We're going to hold a summer school with them and really get them engaged as kind of the next generation as young professionals ourselves.
Sure. So you really have your work cut out for you.
Yeah.
So what's your next step?
I will probably continue managing the Arctic Institute.
And traveling around the world.
The end goal is to really work on climate change adaptation policy at the national level in the U.S. Most of my work now is in the Arctic, but the Arctic is just one piece of a much wider conversation about climate change affecting people. And that's what I'm really interested in, is how does climate change affect people, and how can we best support those communities to make sure that it affects them either in the least harmful way possible, or if it's past a point of adaptation, how can we support communities who have made the difficult decision to relocate to another place? And that's what really interests me, and what I hope to work on at a national level, because there's no national policy on this yet in the future.
So you'll be coming back to the States at some point?
Yeah, I think so.
Well, we'd be thrilled to have you here. Victoria, thanks so much for joining me today. You go, girl.
Thank you so much for having me.
Truly my pleasure. Join us for another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. And if you have a creative woman you think we should interview, contact us at sandyclineshow.com.